chapter 3, Solomon makes some comments and some concluding remarks, particularly in verse 14, that was significant. He said, I perceived that whatever God does, all of these seasons that God has set in place, everything that he's ordained, everything that he does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it or anything taken from it. Why does he do this? Why does he set times and seasons in place? Why does he exercise his sovereignty in this way? Well, because God has done it so that people will fear before him. So our inability to understand God's sovereign determinations of the seasons of human life leads us to do what? To fall on our knees in humble awe and joyfully receive what he's given us. Now, this theme, as we kind of talked about last week, continues through the rest of chapter 3 and into the beginning of chapter 4. But Solomon's going to note several different ways in which this shows up. So if you look, the text that we're looking at today is chapter 3, verses 16 through chapter 4, verse 6. And the reason that we stop at verse 6 is because what grammatical phrase are we looking for that will give us the break? Wait till somebody says it. Somebody knows it. Look in, well, chapter 4, verse 4, at least, at the end of verse 4. There we go. Thank you. We're looking for the phrase, it's a great vanity and striving after the wind, because that phrase breaks up the first half of Ecclesiastes. Okay, so we're going to that point today. So there are three different themes that Qohelet, Solomon, the writer of Ecclesiastes, talks through. And we'll just go ahead and read through the text one time, and then go back and point them out and draw the three of them out. So see if you can observe them as we read through the first time, and then we'll step through the text together. So chapter 3, Ecclesiastes 3, verse 16, says, moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness, and in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. I said in my heart, with regard to the children of man, that God is testing them, that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and to dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth? So I saw that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? Again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun. And behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been and who has not seen the evil deeds that are under the sun, that are done under the sun. Verse 4, then I saw that all toil and all skill in work came from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. The fool folds his hand and eats his own flesh. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and a striving after the wind. Okay, so the three topics that Qohelet is bringing up for us today, look, they're all identified by something that he sees. Okay, so in chapter 3, verse 16, we have the first one, that he saw under the sun that in the place of justice, there was wickedness, and in the place of righteousness, there was wickedness. So that's the first one, is this idea of wickedness, or as we'll look at it a little bit more closely, we could identify it as corruption. Okay. And then he's going to make a few observations about it, right? He says in his heart something. And then in verse 18, he says in his heart again, because remember, he's kind of having this dialogue with his heart as his expedition companion, right? In this great experiment and in all of his studies, he's taking his heart along with him as his companion, at least in how he's writing. Okay, then we have some more discussion here and a conclusion right here in verse 22. He makes a conclusion about the corruption. Okay, then we're going to have at the beginning of chapter 4, a second one. Again, I saw what? Oppressions that are done under the sun. So there's his second topic is oppression. He's going to make some observations about it, right? Something that he's thinking. Then we'll see in verse 4, he's going to draw out his third one. He sees what? That toil and skill and work came from a man's envy of his neighbor. So these are sort of his three themes for the day as he looks through the second part of this section is oppression and corruption and envy and all of these things that he identifies as hevel, right? As frustrating, as mysterious, as even wicked and evil. So he's transitioning back to his observation of life under the sun, right? Because even at the beginning of chapter 3, he's discussed it with a little bit of, like, he stepped out from that experiment a little bit and made observations about the sovereignty of God. And he says, hey, God's eternal, and this is who he is. So we should, this is how he's doing things. So we should fear before him. But now let's zoom back in to our experiment here and say, look, these are other things that I'm seeing under the sun. That's the sphere. And this is true. I mean, we look around us and we see these things. We see injustices and corruption and wickedness. So he's back to kind of expressing the fundamental concept of hevel and the frustration that proverbial living doesn't always show up here under the sun. Righteousness isn't always rewarded. Sometimes wickedness wins, it looks like, in our world. So what do we do with that? What do we live? How do we live in that kind of a world? But one thing that he's drawing out here at the beginning, if you'll notice, is that he's not just saying that wickedness exists, right? Because even as we've gotten used to or lived under life under the sun here, we're sort of used to the concept that there are wicked entities out there, right? Like even just extreme examples, like we would say, well, yeah, in the world, like the drug cartel, there's wickedness there. Or like in a brothel, like there's wickedness that happens there. But that's not really what he's talking about. He's saying that wickedness has come in to places where there should be justice and there should be righteousness. That's what he's saying. So he's observing that it's worse than it seemed. It's not just like good's doing good where it should be and evil's doing evil where it has its proper place. He's like, no, the one has supplanted the other. So you have this perhaps a picture of like the justice system or the courts, right? It's one thing to have a drug lord. It's another thing to have a corrupt cop, right? Like he's the guy that stands for justice. He's the one that you're supposed to be able to run to and expect righteousness. But even there you find wickedness. Or you perhaps even like the court system, right? A corrupt judge where he's receiving bribes. So that essentially you're getting as much righteousness as you can pay for. That's hevel. That's frustrating. That's wickedness or righteousness supplanted by wickedness. So that's kind of the idea that he's generating here. This is his observation, is that there is corruption under the sun. And so what does he say about it? Well, verse 17, he makes an observation that, you know, is helpful. He says, all right, and this is the tie-in back to the earlier portion of chapter 3. He says, I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked. And then we would see this is a familiar phrase, right? For there is a time for every matter and for every work. Well, that sounds exactly like what we looked at last week, because it is. It's a repetition of those two phrases in chapter 3, verse 1 and chapter 3, verse 11. So he sort of takes solace in the fact of God's sovereignty once again, right? That God is going to be, as a sovereign judge who's in control, there will be a time, a season of justice, not only for the sake of the righteous person, not only giving them what they deserve, what they didn't get in the corrupt courts, as it were, but also bringing justice for the oppressor, and also bringing justice to the one who was corrupt. So he's going to judge the righteous and the wicked. Now, what Solomon's not talking about here exactly, he's not articulating end times. He's not articulating what we would look at as like the judgment seat of Christ, right? Or the great white throne, where God's going to judge the wicked. Or the bema seat, where God's going to reward the righteous. He's not, he doesn't have that concept. Not that detailed anyways, not that specific. We're going to talk about this idea a lot more today, the idea of death and what happens after you die, even from an Old Testament perspective, and what Solomon's saying here. So, but he's not articulating like, well, don't worry, Jesus is coming back, and when he does, everything's going to be good. But he does have this fundamental concept that whether it's here or later or whenever it's going to be, God's sovereign, and there's a season for his justice. He knows that, right? He trusts that, that is the character and nature of God. And again, so this strongly ties us back in kind of to the previous section, that there's a season for every matter and for every work. Okay, so what's his other observation in verse 18? It says, okay, I said also in my heart, with regard to us, with regard to humanity, with the children of man, that God is testing them so that they themselves, or so that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. Okay, what in the world is going on here? This is actually a very confusing, complicated, even difficult, the way that the Hebrew phraseology is working here. You could translate it a number of pretty confusing ways. And so we probably should be careful coming down with full certainty about what it means. It can result in various translations, which result in various interpretations. But here's a few options. Okay, so what we kind of know is that it appears that God is, or your translation may, he should test humanity in order to see that he, God, so that he sees, or so that we see some sort of comparison between us and the animals, right? So God either is or he should testing us so that he or we can see a comparison between us and the animals. Okay, so it's like, which could be various different things. It could be tying us in to the previous thought that God is testing to see if man understands his nature, okay, that he's corrupt. So he's just observed corruption, and now he says, now we got to see if God is going to test to see that you're like an animal, meaning that you treat each other savagely, right? There's no sympathy displayed here. It's just like animal war. Like, it's like you're watching the animal, like the Nature Channel, right? When you look out at humanity, it's no sympathy, okay? So it could be that, could be tying us in with this idea of 16, or it could just be one of sort of the themes of Kohelet, right? It could be that humans are limited, right? That we're finite. And what's the life of a cow look like? Well, eat, drink, work, rest, repeat, die. And isn't that sort of what he said human life is like? Where, well, you may as well just eat, drink, enjoy your work, get some rest. You're going to die. Next generation comes. So in that sense, you're kind of like animals, right? Is that what he's saying? So these are two options. Or probably the one that I lean toward a little bit would be the third one. And that is that it's going to tie us into what he says next. And there's a little bit of the finitude of humanity in mind, the limitations, the finiteness of humanity in mind. So let's just read 19 and following again. So he says, because, what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts. So we have this connection between the two, right? And he's going to continue this connection following is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust. All return to dust. Okay, so he's drawn this, I think, the following phrases, what he said next, clarifies the identification that what the point of the metaphor was between man and animals. Seems like he talks about it pretty clearly, following, right? So this is frustrating. I mean, we're the crowning jewel of God's creation, right? We're made in the image of God. And cows aren't, but we die just like them. That seems to be his point of connection. He's not denying that God's created human beings in his image. He's simply metaphorically comparing men to animals based on one particular point. And that is that since the fall of man, humans and animals alike return to dust. In that sense, we are just like them, right? Animals die, humans die. We're no different. We're no more superior. We're not better than the animals in the fact of whether we live or die, right? So the same ugly, painful, disappointing, certain death makes us, in that sense, like the animals. And ironically, it was our fault, not the animals. We did it to ourselves. So here's what I think he's trying to say in this complicated phrase, is that do you understand that the fact of your death proves your finitude? Meaning, the fact that your life will be terminated here on earth, that it will expire, proves that you have limitations. As the creature, right, as the creation, you are inherently limited. In this case, by several things. One, by that your breath is limited, right? But also, your knowledge about what happens afterward is limited. Your knowledge of how things work. And again, going back to last week, why God's established all these seasons at various times. You don't know. You're limited. You are finite. You are the creation. So I think that God's testing of mankind, in one sense, is testing them to see if they will live in such a way that is consistent with their limitations. Are you living like you will die? Are you living like you don't know everything? Or are you living as though you do know everything and you are immortal, right? A lot of people like to live this way. I can't remember who it was. It might have even been somebody from Grace. I don't know. I don't talk to many people outside of Grace. No, it's like I was talking to somebody and they were talking about how somebody was, oh, I remember. It is somebody here. Sorry, Aaron, I'm calling you out. Aaron, so we were talking about you were talking about somebody that was like planning their funeral or talking about how they were going to die, your grandpa, I think, right? And he was like, well, something about like, let's just plan the funeral now. And your sort of knee jerk reaction was, well, no, we're not, you're not in the grave yet. You know, like, let's not be so hasty. And sort of what he's saying is, but we're all going to the grave. You know, like that's where we're all headed. So why not plan your funeral? Why not live like you're going to die? Because you will. Why not live like there's a lot that you don't know? Like be less assertive in some things, right? Be less demanding that this is how it must work. Embrace your finiteness, that there might be something you don't know. This has also come up in various conversations recently about just talking about the idea of How do we know something that's true? How do we know what is absolute truth or what's not? There's, and we won't get into that whole conversation, but we should always embrace the fact that as an observer of the infinite, right, as a finite observer of the infinite, there always might be something I can't see or something I don't understand. So how much better to trust the infinite one than to demand that I have to be able to understand everything, or else I will reject the idea of an infinite one. Isn't that what finite creatures do all the time? I don't understand it, therefore it's not true. That's a risky proposition, isn't it? Okay, so death proves your finiteness, your limitations. Okay, then he takes it a step further. He may be a little bit more offensive to New Testament believers, right? In verse 21, okay? Who knows whether the spirit of man goes up and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth? Okay, we have to be clear here about what Solomon is and is not saying. Remember that his sphere of observation, kind of what he's limiting himself to, is what he can see, what he can observe, right? Have you ever seen someone go to heaven? No. Have you ever seen someone go to hell? No. Have you ever seen someone go anywhere after they die? No. Have you ever been there? No. Life under the sun does not tell you anything about what happens after you die, right? Can't see it. So he's saying, who are you to say? How do you know? How do you know what happens? How do you know where a man's spirit goes, or where the animal's spirit goes? Or who are you to say one goes up, one goes down? You're finite. You've never seen that. Because finiteness limits our knowledge. So his rhetorical question here is answered by saying, well, God's the only one that would know, because he's the only infinite one. No finite creature knows. Yeah, Carol. Okay. So he's observing that we are more than just material, right? He's saying humans are not just stuff. There's an immaterial element to us that doesn't end when we die. Okay, that's a good observation. Yeah, Matt. Mm-hmm. Okay, Genesis 2:7. Okay. Okay, so with the primary like thing that you're drawing out is that you're saying, but there is a distinction between men and animals, right? And absolutely there is. And Solomon's not claiming that there isn't, which is why we have to be careful, because he's drawing one point of comparison, right? We have to be careful with metaphors, right? Because if he's drawing, this is how they're alike, but he says, you know, they're the same. They're the same in this way. Right? He's not saying that everything that's true about an animal is true of you. He's not saying that what happens to an animal when it dies is true of you. He's not saying anything like that. He's simply saying, look, you are like an animal in this way. Your breath expires, their breath expires. Your body returns to dust, their body returns to dust. You're no better than them in that way. Right? With all our knowledge and even our image of God in us and the breath of God in us and our eternal soul and all of this, guess what? Still going to die, just like the animal. In that particular sense. So the point of the metaphor is that one thing, okay? Okay, so just to think briefly, let's think about the Old Testament theology of the afterlife, okay? Because Solomon's not denying an afterlife here. He's not denying the resurrection here. He doesn't have as full of understanding as we do of some of those things. But he's just claimed, even, if you think about it, that God will judge the wicked and the righteous, which doesn't demand, like I said earlier, doesn't demand something after we die, but it implies, and there are other times, I'm not going to show the cards of what he says later right now, but there are other times later that he implies life for the one who fears God after death, right? So he's not denying any of that. In fact, let's just look. If you want to flip to them, you can. I'm just going to read a few things. Job 19. We're just going to think about the Old Testament affirming the continuation of man's life after death. Okay? Just so that we can establish this isn't what he's specifically talking about and these other things. Like Job, he would have had access to. And there's also affirmation in the Old Testament about the resurrection of the body. Right? So they aren't blind in this. Job 19, 25 through 27, Job says, "For I know that my Redeemer lives, and he shall stand at last on the earth. After my skin is destroyed, this I know, that in my flesh I shall see God, and my eyes shall behold, and not another, how my heart yearns within me." Okay, and I know that some of these illustrations or examples will be post-Kohelet as well, but think of Daniel 12. "At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble, such as ever was since there was a nation, even to that time. And at that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt." Or Isaiah 26, 19, "Your dead shall live. Together with my dead body, they shall arise. Awake and sing, you who dwell in dust, for your dew is like the dew of herbs, and the earth shall cast out the dead." Or you have the illustration of David after his child has just died. In 2 Samuel, he says, "When the child was alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, who can tell whether the Lord will be gracious to me that the child may live? But now he is dead. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he shall not return to me." Okay, so just, and that's just a few, right? There's more. Well, those are just a few examples, illustrations to perhaps just quiet that little part of you that's like, but there's more. You know, that's not what Solomon's saying. That's not what he's getting at. That's not his punch. His punch is simply, you're going to die. And in that sense, you have no advantage over the animals. And it proves that there's stuff you don't know and there's stuff you can't do. And you should trust the infinite one. That's essentially what he's saying. Then he sees, we have a familiar conclusion as well in verse 22. "I saw that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what is after him?" Here we have this again. Solomon's not done talking about this, is he? His lot, you remember that? His portion, his chelek, his piece of the pie. That's what God gave him. So he's saying, because of these truths, because you are the finite one who's going to die and you're limited in your knowledge and understanding and the scope of your life is all limited. Because of that, live with a trust that the infinite one is good. Live with a, like, if you can't see what's going to come after, if you can't make these determinations because your observation's limited, why not just enjoy what God's given to you? Isn't that the ultimate kind of expression of relying in the infinite one is just saying, oh, so I'm not supposed to know the answer to that. Okay. In that case, he's not saying stop pursuing wisdom or knowledge, but he's saying you don't have to get the answers to this one. You don't have to make demands on knowing what's going to come after you. Just enjoy what God's given to you. Enjoy your lot in life. Because this question that he brings up here, for who can bring him to see what will be after him, we're not going to major on this right now, because if you flip over to chapter 6, verse 12, this is the thematic question of the second half of the book. For who knows what is good for a man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? And here he asks, who can bring him to see what will be after him? So we're going to hit on this a lot more later. We don't have to maybe major on it right now. Okay, so that's kind of the first one, his thoughts and conclusion about corruption. Now he's going to notice and observe oppressions. Similar theme, right? Similar to the cry against corruption. He says, again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun. Chapter 4, verse 1. And behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. So again, the fact of corruption and oppression under the sun is unavoidable, and it even speaks and shouts to the nature of man and who we are. And the fact that wisdom, even the wisest of men like Solomon, the purpose of wisdom is not to correct or to straighten back up this world so that it's not corrupt and there is no oppression. He's saying wisdom doesn't do that. But you think of all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and you think about the bad ones, like the tears of the oppressed with no one to comfort them. Like you think of like extreme examples of like sex trafficking or manipulation and violence against the weak. Countries in which, you know, the poor are just absolutely neglected, or even a country like our own where the very weakest of our race is just tossed to the side. Even other countries where there's like forced sterilizations or various things, like all of this just ugly, gross, painful, hurtful stuff. And it just seems as though there's just tears flowing from all of these people appropriately because they've been oppressed and it's wicked and no one's there to comfort them. You know, people dying in isolation, starving because the rich government is withholding food or whatever. Just all of these, you can paint whatever picture you want in your mind of this oppression. And Solomon says, you look at this and look in verse 2. I think, Solomon says, the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are alive. He says, you know what? Those who have passed on, don't be sad for them. They escaped the corruption. They escaped the oppression. They're not living in this anymore. And he's pretty upset about this. And rightfully so. He should be, right? There are evil, wicked, vile things happening all around us. And he says, the dead guy's the lucky one. It's a pretty strong, a little bit inciting statement. But then he goes a step further. I mean, from this, it's already kind of cold and harsh. And he's congratulating, as it were, the dead. But think about it from his perspective, right? Life under the sun is filled with hevel. It's everywhere. And death frees you from it. So there's a sense in which, from his observation, this makes sense. But he kind of takes it one step further and says in verse 3, you know what? The unborn child actually is the luckiest of us all, because he didn't even have to see it. He didn't even have to live it. He didn't have to look around and see, you know, these young girls being trafficked. They never got to observe that. How much better off are they? Now, in one sense, he's speaking as a fool, right? God is the one, as we looked at last week, who is the sovereign controller of the season of being born and the season of dying, okay? So God's in control of those things. He's just simply expressing the magnitude of the hevel in which we live. It's almost better if you never had to see it. That's how bad it is. Just for the sake of time, we're going to move to the last thought. His third observation is envy. Okay. The motivation of envy. He sees that all toil and all skill in work. So all of this effort and all of this expertise in our work came because we were envious of our neighbor. So he's using hyperbole, a little bit of exaggeration, you know, with his all of it, everything comes from envy. He's not saying that, but think about our world. Even think about the work world, right? Everything's driven by competition. Everything's driven by trying to one-up the guy next to you, whether that's a company as a whole trying to get a bigger piece of the market, right, a bigger piece of pie, or whether that's the individuals in the company who are all trying to compete with each other to do better than their neighbor so that they get the promotion or they get the raise, right? I mean, it drives us. It's all over the place. So companies and workers are, you know, trying to climb, no holds barred, right? You even think of the imagery we talked about at the very beginning of all of us just in a room on our treadmills, right? And like everyone just on their treadmill trying to work harder than the guy next to him so that he can get better stuff and better like upgrades for his treadmill. And at the end of the day, it's going to expire. Like we're racing towards expiration, trying to be better than the guy next to us or have more than the guy next to us. But eventually the trouble is that your edge wears off, right? Think about like anything, any salesman or sports. Like eventually your age takes you to a point where you don't have the edge anymore, right? So then what do? Well, then you use your wisdom, right? Instead of your strength. And that works for a while, but then even that wears off. So you're not going to be able to maintain this competitive edge. Envy can't always drive you further. So what do you do? What should we do instead? Here's a couple options, right? The one thing is that we can fold our hands and eat our own flesh. Okay, he uses disturbing imagery of the lazy person, right? He says, okay, so there's the one guy that's like, yeah, this is crazy. Look at all this competition driving everyone, and everyone's just like driven by envy. Forget it. I'm not going to play that game. I'm out, right? I'm not going to work. And so he's just going to fold his hands. Or the Hebrew is like his hands are hugging. They're embracing, right? So he's folding his hands. But what does that get him? Nothing. The picture here is kind of grotesque, right? He's eating his own flesh. He's consuming himself by not working. So the answer is not laziness, okay? How about this? Work harder. Let's just, two hands full of toil, right? Let's just, under the gun, let's go, hit the gas. Is that the solution too? Well, there you're just going to get striving after the wind, which you remember that. I mean, that's pretty hevel in and of itself, isn't it? You're shepherding the wind. It's an impossibility. At the end of the day, your two hands are full of nothing. Two hands that are working so hard end up empty. So what is the solution? He suggests this in verse 6. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil. Does anyone have a different translation of the beginning of 6? Okay, better one handful with rest. With is better than of. Here, this is not a great translation. The ESV has failed me. With. Okay, so here's what he's suggesting. He's suggesting moderation. He's suggesting be satisfied with enough rather than to let the competition and envy drive you to more and more. Imagery, right, is two hands look better than one. Isn't that every child ever? I think of Halloween, right? You can grab a handful. Oh, a handful? You know, like I'll get as much as I can. And what he's saying is, or actually, let me give you, I'm pretty much out of time, but there was one time as a kid that I was helping some like service guy that came to work on our house. And we like had a great relationship. I was like helping, you know, giving him his tools or whatever. And he asked my parents afterwards if he could take me to 7-Eleven to get a Slurpee. And they said, yes. I don't even think we knew this guy, seriously. But I went to with him and he's like, go ahead and pick, you know, pick whatever you want, pick a drink. So what did I do? I'm like less than 10 years old. I grabbed the biggest big gulp there was and filled it up. Right? I mean, you know how big they are? Like they're huge. And I'm just like, sweet, he's getting me this drink. No moderation. And the story ends poorly for me because it was embarrassing because I ended up like, I think I just blamed it on him because I was embarrassed, but I dropped it. Like I'd filled it up all the way and then I dropped it, right? Better for me to have had a handful with contentment than to have two hands full of striving after the wind, right? Moderation is a good thing. This is what he's attacking. Is bigger always better? Is more money always better? Is Cadillac always better than Ford? Is 400 square feet always better than 200 square feet? Or 4,000, 2,000, how about that? Is a bigger business better than a small business? Is a promotion better than staying where you're at? Not necessarily. But that's what our world would say yes to all of, right? Absolutely. More is better. Bigger is better. Shinier is better. 2020 is better than 2018. I was just having a conversation with Jerry. I think it was last Sunday. He had mentioned somebody recommending to him. He's like, Jerry, why don't you hire somebody to help you, right, with your work? Because, even in that conversation, you said, because then this person suggested to him, you'll be able to get more done faster. You'll be able to make more money. You'll be more efficient. And Jerry's response is, why don't I just have a handful of work with quietness? I'll just take the moderate approach. Nothing wrong if you went and hired somebody, you know, absolutely not. But that was kind of your response to me. It was like, sounds like maybe more trouble than it's worth. I think I'll just keep doing my thing. Yeah, he's been there. Two handfuls full of toil, right? Yeah. So he's saying, don't spend your life acquiring, chasing, toiling. Be content with a handful. That's your lot. And some people have a bigger handful than others. That's God's prerogative. He can give a lot to a wicked person and a little to a righteous person. He could give a lot to a righteous person and a little to a wicked person. He can do whatever he wants. So he's saying, stop just trying to strive and build and get bigger, because at the end of the day, you'll realize you don't get to keep it. It wasn't actually worth it. Instead of enjoying the lot in your life, you pursued and chased and chased. So that's one of the concluding thoughts is for that. And then just to restate, and we'll close, concerning corruption and oppression. We trust the divine judgment of God who sets the times. Because after all, we are not infinite. Look at us. We keel over just like cattle, right? We live and die. And that demands me to acknowledge and face my finiteness. A proper understanding of who I am inherently leads me to enjoy the day ahead of me with the tasks in it, because that's what God has given me. A lot more we could say. Some more things we probably should have said. But we'll leave that for another day. Let's close.